Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
A listener production.
Hey, I'm pro surfer
and mental health advocate Kubi Chapman, and this is Good Humans. I want to start this episode a little bit differently. I want to say thank you to everybody who's tuned in so far. It means the absolute world to me to know that these conversations I've been having with my amazing guests have been having a real good impact and really positive impact on the community around me. So thank you to everyone who's tuned in. If you want to support us, make sure you like, subscribe, and leave a review, because your feedback means the world to me and can really help us get this podcast to as many people who need to hear it. I've also just created a Good Humans podcast on Instagram, so make sure you check that out. We're going to be putting updates on there. We're also going to be doing a few really cool giveaways. So yeah, thanks heaps to everyone who's listened, and hopefully we can continue to bring you some amazing conversations. All right, on to today's episode. Imagine being a kid growing up in a country that's main focus is on one sport. Everyone's obsessed with it, including you. It's produced the most successful sporting team in history. The world looks at them as a benchmark to beat, and all you want to do is play for them when you grow up. In this chat, I speak to Anton Lennett Brown, who got his dream to play for the rugby union team, the New Zealand All Blacks. I chat to Anton about what kind of pressure you create in your own mind to live up to this dream, and how does he keep a level head when the expectations of a whole nation is weighing on your shoulders, especially when you lose? Anton, thanks for coming on Good Humans Podcast.
Thanks, Cooper. Thanks, brother. Geez, it's a hell of an intro. You know how to pump up my tires.
Oh, come on. You got to blow them off a little bit. Just get you all pumped to be on the potty.
Yeah.
Me and Anton met last year actually in Hawaii. I was over there for a surf comp, and a few of the All Blacks boys were at Turtle Bay playing some golf, and Billy Stammond, who's been a previous guest on this podcast and a great friend of mine, is representing New Zealand in the Olympics next year in surfing, and he invited the All Blacks over, and all of us boys were like, no way, like I'm a bit of a sucker for meeting high profile, not high profile, but highly successful sports people, because I love picking their brains and seeing how awesome they are. And when you guys came over, it was like Christmas.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's so cool how across sports we can just connect and everyone has so much in common. It's so nice to meet great people like yourself.
Yeah. And to be fair, like there was probably the highlight of my trip was meeting at the Volcom house and meeting all you surfing lads. And I love doing that as well, you know. We were a few deep, but we talked about, I guess, how we go about things in different ways. You for surfing and me for rugby. But, you know, I'm a big believer that a lot of success aligns. You know, we share similar values, and we go through pressures in different way, but it's all pressure at the same time.
Yeah, for sure. And I'm stoked to have you on here. I'm really excited to get to know you a bit better through, yeah, this conversation. So I want to rewind. I obviously haven't known you for a long time, and talk me through sort of growing up, family life when you're a kid, and sort of that development into that rugby career that you have now.
Yeah, I guess in New Zealand, and this is probably where it's a little bit different in Aussie, because you've got so many sports over there. But in New Zealand growing up, rugby's sort of everything as a Kiwi kid. And when I was 4 years old, that's when my dad sort of dragged me down to the rugby club. Or he didn't drag me down, because I was so excited to go and play. And I started playing at 4 years old in bare feet. And then I guess I just grew my love of the game from there. You know, went to a pretty good high school, Christchurch Boys. And then, yeah, I think, you know, just slowly developed. And here I am now, a dream come true. I'm an All Black, and I play professional rugby full time.
Yeah, it's such a special thing. And like you said, coming from a country that's so well known for rugby union, and the All Blacks are the best sports team of all time, to be involved in that is amazing. And we're going to get into that a little bit later. But at what stage did you know rugby union was going to be your passion and that was something that you wanted to do for a living?
Shit, I sort of put all my eggs into one basket. I loved sport, and I guess, you know, all through school, that's what I wanted to do. And looking back on it now, you know, I guess the wise thing to say would probably be, you know, make sure you study. So if it falls through, you have something to fall back on. But at the time, I just loved sport, and I didn't know if I was going to be a professional rugby player, but that's all I dreamed of, and that's all I sort of worked towards.
Yeah, it's so cool. I love those stories of people, and I've had a few other guests on my podcast that have been, it almost works 50-50, half are all eggs in one basket and half are, oh, I had kind of a few options, but then I just fell in love and I was really talented at it. So it's cool to hear your story. So you went into Super Rugby at 18 years old. Was that straight out of high school?
Well, it sort of was in a way, but it wasn't. So my last game of high school, I was a year young. So I finished when I was 17. I dislocated my shoulder in that last game. And I actually took a year off rugby. Well, I didn't take a year off, but I couldn't play for a year. So 2013, I was pretty much just training and rehabbing and stuff like that. And how sort of an opportunity come about for Super was, because I missed that year off, the Chiefs are like, oh, we'll take you in the wider training group. We'll speed up your progress. But don't worry, you won't play. We know you haven't played since high school. And, you know, they sort of shot themselves in the foot a little bit because every man and his dog went down and I was left. And here I was debuting at 18 years old on the wing, which was a great experience. But I didn't play. That was my first game back since high school, a year and a half early. So earlier, so it was a big step from what I was used to.
Yeah, that's so special. I didn't know that. What was it like? What was it like running under the pitch that first time? What kind of feelings did you go through? Was there? I'm guessing there was a lot of nerves, but it must have made you excited to get back on the field in such a huge stage. Probably the biggest game you've ever played was coming back after probably one of your worst injuries.
Yeah, there was a lot of nerves, but also excitement. I guess at the time I had a lot of good people around me. You probably won't know these boys because you don't follow a lot of rugby, but like Tim Nono Williams, Liam Messam, and we had Wayne Smith and Dave Rennie as coaches, and they sort of helped me get through those moments and gave me comfort. So I was hugely excited, but obviously at the same time, nervous.
Yeah, coming into a team being so young, that transition from schoolboys rugby to being probably the best in your team growing up into the bigger league and the big boys, was that difficult?
Yeah, for sure. Sort of my ego and my expectations, you know, was to be the best or one of the best every game. And that's all I knew. I was fortunate enough through high school, whatever sport I played, I normally was one of the best. And, you know, I don't want to sound cocky or anything, but that's how it was. But that gave me a real false sense of what it's going to be like at professional rugby. And at 18 years old, I was debuting on the wing, and I'm used to scoring, you know, a try or setting up a try game. And my ego took a big hit because, in all honesty, I didn't have a great game, and it was sort of a welcome to Super Rugby. And this is what it's all about.
Yeah, it's so cool that you can look back and reflect on that now and say, yeah, maybe there was that inflated ego, and it's probably a very big reality check when you've got the best players in the world putting it on you every game, and that sort of pressure must be intense.
Yeah, I think, you know, I was very naive going into my debut, but after it, it was sort of a shock, and I realised what it was all about. And I guess going through that whole year and probably the next couple of years, I realised how much hard work you have to put in to be one of the top players. And like you said before, you also realise that everyone's as talented as you, if not more talented.
Yeah, and so that's that hard work and work ethic that gets you to those places you want to be. And talent only gets you so far, and obviously your work ethic is second to none. If you can get to be playing for the All Blacks, the best team of all time, it's such a testament to the sort of player you are. Do you think having that a bit of a reality check when you first got to Super Rugby helped you regain motivation to start lifting your game and improving your game so you could get back to being the best in the division you're in?
Yeah, it was probably, like, at the time, it really sucked. And I get this is probably, this is going to the mental health side of things. And this is why I'm such a big advocate for it now. But after that debut, I went to a pretty dark place. You know, I was 18 years old, had all these expectations on myself. And obviously I didn't meet them. And it probably took me a good year to regain confidence in my ability as a rugby player. That's literally what one game did to me. So I guess it made me have to reassess of, like, my values and I guess and how I judge myself as a person. And you know, those next 2 years was massive for me. I realized that rugby was how I judged myself as a person. So my performances were, I guess, attached to my personality. And it's pretty dangerous when you do that, because I guess through professional sport, you ride highs and lows all the time. And if you think you're a bad person after a bad performance, it's pretty tough. And vice versa, if you think you're the man after a good performance, it's just not a good way to live. So, you know, I went through a tough stage to the point where I lost my love for rugby. I was ready to sort of give it up, go be a tradie and enjoy being down at the pub every Thursday, Friday, Saturday. But I stuck at it, and, you know, I wouldn't change it for the world going through, you know, that year or that probably couple years of tough times, because it's set me up to be a lot stronger and a lot more aware of how things are.
Yeah, for sure. Having that capacity to reflect and understand that. Was there a point or a turning point where you went, you know what, my mindset needs to change? Or was it something that you gradually happened?
The point was probably, for me, was a dark, you know, a dark place where, you know, I really, really struggled. I felt burnt out. I wasn't enjoying my rugby. I developed, like, quite bad anxiety on the field. I got actually really, like, scared of going out there and performing. So that was a point where I was like, well, there's two ways about this. I've either got to do something about how my mind's operating, or I've just got to give it up because I can't live this way. And I guess when I got to that point, that's when I started making those changes. I started being vulnerable. I didn't talk to anyone before that. I'd keep it within myself. If you probably talked to those people between my age of 18 and 20, they would have had no idea how I felt inside, because I wasn't a person to share things. But once I started learning how important it is to open up, be vulnerable, it changed my life, and it changed me as a footy player. And that was my biggest learning.
Yeah, it's so powerful. And I love I don't know if you've heard of Brené Brown, and she talks about courage is vulnerability, and you can't have one without the other. And being a top level athlete, especially someone who's got the consequences of running at big blokes on the footy field, courage does come with vulnerability, and it can come in so many different shapes and sizes. And it's so beautiful that you found that. And what sort of things when you were, like, that 18 to 20 is that real development stage. And that, like you said, I felt the exact same way when I was that age in surfing. I had quite a bit of ego. I had transitioned out of my junior career into the big leagues, and you kind of go, whoa, all right, life's a bit different. And it probably is the hardest time to ask for help, because this is how I felt in my head. I did have everything going for me, and I shouldn't be feeling this, I guess, weakness and not having the confidence that I felt like I should have. And I had all my friends and family and support around me, like everything was going right. But yeah, it's such a scary place to get to. And it's so awesome that you had that ability to reflect and realize that, yeah, I do need to ask for help. And what sort of support system, was there much structure and support in your sporting organization through rugby when it came to sports psychologists and whatnot around that area?
Yeah, when I first started professional rugby when I was obviously 18. That was 2014. And probably around that time, there wasn't a lot of help. You know, it's probably been in the last 3-4 years where there's been a massive shift on the importance of, you know, mental well-being and opening up. So at the time, you know, it wasn't the thing to go and talk to someone. Mm. Yes, there was the resources around us, but did I feel encouraged to go do that? No, not at all. So I sort of just kept it to myself. And, you know, in New Zealand, there's a huge problem in society. As men, we keep things in, and I'm sure it's the same over there in Aussie. But yeah, I just, at the time, I just felt between 18 and 20, obviously I was new. I wanted to fit in. I didn't want people to think I was different or I couldn't handle it. So yeah, in all honesty, how I felt, I probably didn't feel as though I had a lot of support, but if I wanted to seek their help, I could have got it. But the biggest thing is that you have to go and get it. And I see what I have now as tools. So like a tool is being vulnerable, being open, and stuff like that. But at that time, I didn't have those tools in my toolbox. There's a lot of other factors that made me keep it within myself.
Yeah, and thank you so much for sharing that, because I know it's people like yourself and myself and people who are willing to have those tough conversations and willing to share that inspire so many others. So thank you for sharing that. And I know so many people listening get so much inspiration from people like yourself. So you should be really proud of that. Let's jump into the All Blacks career. Tell me about the day you found out you're going to be an All Black. That must have been surely it's got to be the best day of your life, being a Kiwi, knowing how important the All Blacks are to your guys' country. What was the day like you found out you're going to be an All Black?
Yeah, it was crazy. Actually, my sort of journey into All Blacks was a little bit different. So it wasn't like the squad got named and I was in there. I actually came in as injury cover, and then there was a couple more injuries, and then I got my shot. So I got pretty much brought into the squad late. So initially the big hype around the squad announcement I missed, and then probably 3-4 weeks down the track I got named the squad. And when I got named the squad, I think then I realised like the impact the All Blacks have in New Zealand, and it was such a special feeling to have so many people reach out to me. I rang mum and dad and they cried and stuff like that. And yeah, I guess, like, you know, I've been dreaming. Well, I dreamt of it since I was 4 years old. You know, as long as I can remember, to be an All Black, I never thought it would happen, but it did. You know, I literally thought you had to be Superman to be an All Black. And when I became an All Black, I realized that, you know, anyone can do it if you're willing to work hard.
Man, I'm getting goosebumps just hearing you talk about that. I mean, I love professional sport more than anything. I'm the biggest sports fan, and the All Blacks are known globally as the best sport team of all time. What sort of pressure does that add to coming into a team like that?
Yeah, it's the whole, I guess, like you envision before you go into the All Blacks, you envision that pressure because you know the standard that they have to live up to. And I think that's how you think it's going to be within the environment. But when I walked into the All Blacks environment, they were, you know, like so caring. They got around me, supported me.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
And things were pretty relaxed. Obviously, they had a standard, but there's just so many factors that, I guess, in a way, I think they realise the pressure that is on the All Blacks team, but they sort of like peel the pressure back within the team. So, you know, if you're outside of the team, you probably feel more pressure than if you're in it, because they're so good at not not getting caught up in the pressure of the, I guess, external factors. And internally, we just keep it to ourselves, and we know what works and we know what we need to do. And internally, we don't actually feel the pressure as much.
Yeah, it's really cool. And like the first word that comes to mind when I think of All Blacks is discipline. What do you think makes the All Blacks so successful over the last two decades, three decades?
That's a great question.
You can't sell state secrets here, huh?
There's honestly no secret like to it. But I do think within New Zealand, you know, I'm a big believer that your like foundation's got to be good. So obviously the All Blacks are at the top, but we have Mitre 10 Cup, which is your provincial, even club rugby, then provincial, then super, then All Blacks. So I guess you've got a good system that eventually the best players make it up to the top, and they've been through good systems the whole way. And just on that, like, it's probably the people within the environment. And I'm not talking about the players, but I'm talking about the coaches, the physios, trainers, even our bus driver, bloody managers. Like, everything's world class. Everyone just does their job. And it's a great organisation. Like, if I can put it in a way, like, everyone at some point has to turn the wheel. And they do. They do their bit. They don't try to do too much. They don't do too less. They just do their job to a world-class standard, and that's what drives us.
Yeah, it's so awesome, and I can see that every time I watch you guys play and watch you guys flog my Aussie Wallabies. I can just see the world-class and the dedication that you guys have to being world-class, and unless you – like, you guys aren't going out there to win. You guys are going out there to embarrass teams, and that's the testament to, like you said, your guys' coaching staff and the system that you guys have come up through. It makes it so good to watch. But tell me a little bit about the average week when you're touring with the All Blacks.
Yeah, so I guess, yeah, a Monday's like a light day. Well, it's a big gym day, so it's a full body. And then after that, we'll have our review. And I guess depending on how things went, like, reviews are always very honest. And the best thing I like about it as well is, you know, we could have beaten a team by 40 points, but we always find things to work on. Mm. I guess we're never satisfied, and we're always trying to get better. And then the Arvo, we sort of look at next week, so we have clarity, walk through what we're going to go through for the next week. Tuesday's a big on-grass training day in the morning. And that's probably like at 70 to 80%, whereas we put clarity into a bit of speed. And the Arvo, we do a gym, and that's like individualized to ourselves. And then one thing we do on Tuesday night, which I think's, you know, a massive part of us, is we have club rooms. So we all put on our club jerseys. So like the first club we played for, we come together, we have like a club captain, he runs the whole thing, and we have a few beers, plenty of laughs, and then go out to dinner as a team. And I guess in amongst all the pressure, that sort of releases it, because I guess you come back to your roots and you have a beer with your mate, and you sort of just get to forget about everything that's going on. Wednesday, day off, normally play golf. Thursdays, in the morning, it's a power session, and I call the Arvo's like a dress rehearsal. So we're going at full speed for about 40 minutes, running through our moves fast. Friday's a light jog through, so the captain's run. And then Saturday we play. So that's a little bit of a structure to the week.
And I feel like for you guys as well, because you play Chiefs all year round, and then international rugby is like another little tour, yeah? How many games does All Blacks play a season?
Yeah, it's 14 games. So it's quite a few, because I guess at Super Rugby we play, well, now it's all changed, but normally you play about 16 and then finals. So like it's a few, just a few less than what you do with Super Rugby. Whereas I think in league, they obviously the bulk of their season's with their franchise or their NRL team, and then there's a little window for international.
Yeah, yeah, it's definitely a lot different. How much time do you guys who do have the honour to play for the All Blacks get off in between international rugby season and then back into Super Rugby season?
Yeah, we normally get December, January off. So you're pretty much like, well, 10 months on, like 2 months off, but you probably have a good 1 month where, you know, you have it off, and then the 1 month before you go back, you're doing a bit of training.
Yeah, that's what I've heard. That month before seasons, the pre-season's the hardest training, because that's when you don't get those kind of chill days after playing your game.
Yeah, yeah. So we're pretty lucky because we only have about 3 weeks of pre-season before we go back into season, whereas the other boys have about 9 weeks of it. So, yeah.
Yeah. All right. I'm gonna give you a bit of a hard one. 2019 World Cup semi-final against England. What sort of feelings as coming from New Zealand, you guys are the hot favourites and you guys have all that pressure, not pressure, but all that pride in your country behind you. What sort of feelings go through your head after losing that semi-final?
Yeah, obviously you're gutted. You're gutted, you're shattered. In a way, you're embarrassed. I guess we had the expectation behind us and we didn't reach it. But at the same time, like, I'd done so much work on, I guess, my individual mental health. And I did quite a lot of it at the World Cup with Artie. And I felt all those emotions, you know. I felt, as we should, like, we felt disappointed. Mm. We felt we let the country down, felt embarrassed. But at the same time, I had the tools to manage that. And I remember, well, this is probably a pivotal moment for me to know that I've grown in that space. And it was the next day, and we had a All Black tour group staying in our hotel. And there would have been about 50 of them standing in the foyer, and I was going to breakfast with my parents. And I chucked my hoodie up because I didn't want them to see me. And just before I went to walk through them, I put it down, and I stood up, held my chin up, and I just walked through them with my head held high. And, you know, I thought, you know, I've done all this work with the mental health, and now I feel embarrassed, but that shouldn't change who I am. You know, I know these people would be disappointed, but, you know, I'm still Anton, and obviously it sucked what happened the night before, but I shouldn't feel that way.
Yeah, hell yeah, that's such a special thing, and thanks for sharing that. It's really cool, and you should be really proud of that, because it does take a lot for an athlete to be able to take those losses on the chin. At the end of the day, we're humans. You're just going out there doing your absolute best. So when you get those haters, it's stupid. It's the dumbest thing ever, but it happens. With rugby, do you find it really hard to switch off when it comes to switching off from rugby? Like you said, you only get 2 months off. What sort of things do you do, and what sort of techniques do you use when it comes to those losses? Like you said just then, you had a few more techniques going into the World Cup. What sort of things do you do that help you with that?
Sort of switching off for me now is a lot easier. When I first came into professional rugby, my mind was ticking over a lot and worrying a lot. And I think, you know, just in time, you sort of relax and you find your process, and you realise what's required. I love playing golf. I do some like meditation, visualization to get away from it. Actually, last year at the World Cup, I did a lot of Wim Hof stuff.
Oh, I love Wim Hof.
Yeah, he's awesome. And I guess, you know, from someone that suffered from anxiety in the past, it really helped, and it sort of chilled me out a lot. So hopefully over this summer, I do some more of that ice stuff again, because I love it. And I guess, you know, you have that, just going doing a little spiel on the ice stuff, we've got a flight and fright mechanism, you know, that's how we react to things. But, you know, getting into really cold ice up to your neck puts you in that situation, and once you learn to get through that and you control the breath, it's done wonders for me, eh? So, and I know it's not for everyone, but I'll definitely recommend to try it.
Yeah, I love that. So anyone listening, that's Wim Hof. He's the ice shaman, they call him. He's all about He's crazy. He's all about – he's set all the world record. Yeah, he gets under ice water and there's all these different health benefits for him. That's what Anton was talking about. And I think the main one is just – I don't know if you've seen the Yes Theory video where they went and did stuff with Wim Hof. If you haven't, you should go watch it. It's like a little 40-minute documentary. Have you seen it?
I don't know if I've seen that.
I'll send you the link after this. It's really cool, and it's their whole thing's about seeking discomfort and showing what the mind is capable of doing. And just – I feel like if you go out there and look for stuff, you can find so much information about ways to basically hack your brain and become a better person. And I know it's something important to you. What sort of books and TED Talks would you recommend, and what sort of things have you been inspired by over the last couple of years to have those techniques to overcome those difficult times in life?
Oh, a big book for me was The Subtle Art of Not Giving a Fuck. I sort of, at the time, I cared too much about what people thought of me. So it was quite timely when I read that book. But you spoke about her before, Brené Brown. I just absolutely love her books and love her TED Talks and what she's about. I love the word vulnerability, and it's really helped me grow as a person, because as you said before, you can't be courageous if you're not vulnerable. So every situation I put myself into where people will see that as courage, I just think be vulnerable. And I just like that as a better way to think about things, because it wipes out the fear of failure when I just think be vulnerable, because it gives me confidence to go into that situation and not worry about probably the biggest factor to why people don't do things, and that's the fear of failure.
It's such a powerful thing, and it's a really hard thing to overcome, and it's so awesome that you've come to terms with that, and it seems like you're in such a good space mentally, and I bet you inspire a lot of your teammates, so you should be really proud of that. Speaking of rugby, you touched on a little bit that it's definitely changed a bit, but do you feel the culture in rugby union has still got that toxic masculinity kind of side to it? Or do you think it's starting to shift a little bit to being more open with mental health and supporting the players through those times? Because it is such a high-pressure environment, and there is going to be those difficult times.
I think, we're making good shifts, but we can still, go a long way. I think, for players that have experienced tough times or go out there and seek information and start building their toolbox, they understand it. But there's other players out there that, and I don't blame them, you can only see what you've seen. I talk about it with some other players and it doesn't hurt me in any way, but they're not sort of about that, or some coaches or people within an environment. But I think, the more we talk about it and the more people understand the importance of it, that's when we'll make really good shifts. And, in New Zealand, the typical male is sort of, you grow up in a way to think, you've got to be tough, you can't show weakness. And so that's your typical New Zealand male, but your typical New Zealand male that plays rugby, that's probably, times by five, because now you're this guy in the spotlight and you don't show weakness. And I think that's why, a few of us in amongst the All Blacks are going hard in the mental health space to show that, look, we can be these big tough guys on the field, but, emotionally we go through tough times and we know the importance of opening up.
Yeah, and it's the more and more I think about it, it's so special that you and a few of the boys around you are getting involved in the area, and it's, I'm so stoked to have you on the podcast, because that's what it's all about. It's about trying to use your profile and use the amazing platform that you have, being, especially like you said, in New Zealand, rugby is everything, and the rugby players are meant to be these big macho strong men, which you're not a strong man by talking about your feelings and being open. You're just being honest and vulnerable, because I feel like 90% of guys go through the same stuff, but only 30% of us might have the capacity and the vulnerability to be able to share it. So the more that we can have these conversations, and that more the people like you and podcasts like this can show that people of your stature can be open about it, it's so inspiring, and I'm so stoked to have you on here.
Cheers, brother. It's a pleasure to be on it.
So my last question that I always ask everyone is, what does being a good human mean to Anton Linnett Brown?
Geez, I'm so glad you asked that question because, you know, I love the name, A Good Human. And when I look at things and look at people, I just see them like as human beings. And I guess that's how I want to be perceived like in society. And that's how I want people to know that like us, like athletes are or celebrities are, at the end of the day, they're doing the great things in the limelight, but at the end of the day, they're only human. And a good human to me just holds, you know, good values. They're consistent. They have good manners, but they also make mistakes, you know. And I think that's where like society gets things wrong, is mm-hmm. that, you know, we sort of create this perception of perfection. And I'm not a big fan of when a rugby player makes a mistake or a celebrity makes a mistake, and that they're sort of, you know, they do apologise and they're hugely scrutinised, but they also don't let the public know that these people are just human, you know, and you've made those mistakes as well, and they make mistakes too, because, you know, I really want, you know, society to realise that, you know, if the people we look up to, if our role models can make mistakes, then when they make a mistake, that's all right. But I think what they're really seeing at the moment is these perceived perfect people who they look up to, and then they make a mistake and they're like, oh, like, I'm never going to be like that person because I've made a mistake. But I make mistakes all the time. You know, no one's perfect. And I guess that's what I'd love to see in society, and that's how I'd like to see it grow, is to realise that we are all human beings. We are all good human beings, and it's okay to make mistakes, hold good values, be consistent. Life's not perfect, and everything's okay.
Mate, that is so beautifully put. Normally, every guest gets tongue-tied with that, and it just shows the sort of person you are, how sure you are of what sort of values you hold. And, mate, I'm so stoked to have this chat, and it's been nice to just catch up.
Yeah, 100%, bro.
Thanks again for being on the podcast, mate. It's been an absolute pleasure. And, yeah, thanks to everybody who's online listening.
Cheers, brother.
Good Humans was presented by me, Cooper Chapman. Producer, Alex Mitchell. Audio production by Darcy Thompson.
Listener. Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.